Excuse me, this coordinator. I'd like to inform parties today's conference is being recorded. If anyone has an objection, you may disconnect at this time. If anyone needs any further assistance, press star zero. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. This is Mary Beth Merle. I'm the Cassini Science Communication Coordinator, and this is part two of our charm sessions devoted to Cassini's fifth anniversary at Saturn. CHARM is an acronym for Cassini-Huygens Analysis and Results from the Mission. And in these sessions, we go into more detail than usual about the scientific findings, and you can ask questions. This mission is so productive with so many discoveries that we need two of these sessions just to cover the first 5 years of greatest hits. So today we have three more luminaries from the Cassini science team to describe some of the most exciting results the mission has gathered about Saturn's rings, Titan, and the icy satellites. First up is Dr. Linda Spilker, who is the Deputy Project Scientist for Cassini at JPL. She has a key role since the beginning of the project in managing the mission's science planning, observations, and analysis. Her own research interests are focused on the rings, and today she's going to provide an overview of the mission science. Second will be Dr. Jeff Cuzzi, Cassini interdisciplinary scientist for rings and dust. He's at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, and he has the job of bringing together all the ring studies to understand the rings from start to finish, their origin, evolution, and current state and their future. He will share what we've learned so far about the rings and describe some of the new questions raised by information that Cassini has returned. Finally, Dr. Elizabeth Turtle, Zippy Turtle, will join us. She is an associate member of the Cassini imaging team and a research scientist in the Planetary Exploration Group at Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Lab in Maryland. Her research interests include Titan's lakes, impact cratering, and crater formation and modification. And she'll share what we've learned so far about these fascinating worlds. So we'll try and work in some questions as each speaker ends. And each presentation will be about 20 minutes to a half an hour long or so. And if the speakers would please remind us often what page you were on in your presentation, that'll help us all keep up. And you'll find links to some movies and animations as we go along. We hope you've downloaded those ahead of time, but if not, they'll be there after the CHARM telecon is done. And this will exist on the website. An audio recording is being made, and this will all be posted in the next several days. Thank you. Linda?
Thank you very much, Mary Beth. Well, what I'd like to do is set the stage for the discussion of the rings by Jeff and the icy satellites and Titan by Zibby by explaining a little bit about the mission, how it got its name, and what our plans are, both present and future. So with that, if you go to page 3 of my presentation, it says Huygens and Cassini, the scientists and machines. It shows the scientist for which the Cassini-Huygens mission is named. Jean-Dominique Cassini was an Italian-French astronomer, and he was an individual who discovered a number of Saturn satellites, including Iapetus, Rhea, Tethys, and Dione. And in particular, he discovered, looking through Earth-based telescopes, a gap between two of Saturn's rings, between the A ring and the B ring, and that gap is named the Cassini division in his honor. And so that's where the Cassini division gets its name for the Huygens probe. That was named after the Dutch scientist Christian Huygens, and he was the one who discovered that Saturn's rings were actually rings of material and not separate, discrete moonlets, such as Galileo had hypothesized when he first discovered the rings of Saturn. And he also was the one that discovered Titan as well. So it's appropriate that a probe that would go into Titan's atmosphere would be named after Huygens. On page 4 are photographs of the Cassini orbiter and of the Huygens probe. You can see for scale little people in white suits at the base of the Cassini orbiter. The spacecraft is about 2 stories tall. And you can see that the Huygens probe on the right is covered with those brown heat-resistant tiles, and those tiles ablated and carried away the heat as the probe first entered Titan's atmosphere. Cassini-Huygens is an international mission. Both NASA and the European Space Agency run it together. And another key member is the Italian Space Agency. They have a bilateral agreement with NASA, and they provided hardware both for the orbiter and for some of the science instruments. On page 5 is a diagram of the Cassini spacecraft, giving some of its specifications, the fact it's about 22 feet tall, that white high-gain antenna is about 13 feet across, and also the mass of the spacecraft. The mass is 2.8 tons, and if you add the fuel plus the Huygens probe, then you have a spacecraft weighing fully loaded at launch 6 tons. At Saturn orbit insertion, that's what SOI stands for, we had about 700 watts of power. That power is provided by 3 radioisotope thermoelectric generators, where we take the heat from nuclear decay and turn that into, that radioactive decay, turn it into the power that runs the instruments and all of the computers on board the spacecraft. You can see we have 2 engines, 2 490 Newton engines. In particular, that was important for when we went into orbit around Saturn. We had to perform a 90-minute burn, and if something had gone wrong, we wanted the spacecraft to autonomously switch to the backup engine and continue to get us into orbit about Saturn. We have digital recorders on board Cassini that send back data, and the way the spacecraft works is that we, since all of the instruments are fixed to it, we actually have to turn the entire spacecraft to point in a given direction or at a given target, and we spend typically on a given day about 15 hours collecting science data and then turn back and downlink to the Earth through the high-gain antenna for about typically 9 hours. For Cassini instruments, there are 3 different sets of instruments. The first set are the optical remote sensing instruments, and that includes the composite infrared spectrometer SEERS, who measures the composition and also the temperatures of the objects that we fly by. The imaging science subsystem has both a narrow and wide-angle camera and a series of filters and also polarizers, and we use these to take pictures of the targets in the Saturn system. The ultraviolet imaging spectrograph makes measurements in the ultraviolet, can also determine composition, and as well it has a high-speed photometer that allows it to observe a star as it goes behind objects such as the rings or the atmosphere of Saturn or Titan and make scientific measurements in that way. And then there's the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer. It has both a visual component and a near-infrared component. In the near-infrared, that's another place to get composition of the rings, Saturn, the icy moons, and of Titan as well. And the microwave remote sensing, 2 instruments, the radar. We have Cassini radar, which includes a synthetic aperture radar as well as radiometry. And in particular, this instrument was put on board Cassini to map the surface of Titan through the clouds and give us detailed information and topography information as well about the surface of Titan. But we can also use radar to look at the surfaces of the icy satellites and to look at the rings and then to do radiometry on the atmosphere of Saturn. In the magnetosphere and plasma science group, there's 1 instrument that's missing there. We'll have to get this chart fixed. That's the Cassini plasma spectrometer, or CAPS instrument. It includes both an electron spectrometer and an ion mass spectrometer over a broad energy range, and so we can get the composition of the ions that comes into this detector. And this has been particularly useful for the atmosphere of Titan and also for measuring the composition in the plumes of the icy moon Enceladus. Cosmic Dust Analyzer is an instrument that measures both the directional flux as well as the mass of incoming particles, tiny particles. You can think of them as icy dust particles in the Saturn system. And it's an instrument that can point in a given direction and then get the flux of those particular particles. And it can get the composition as well. There's also the ion and neutral mass spectrometer. This mass spectrometer gives us composition up to about 100 AMU, 100 Daltons, atomic mass units, and is very good in particular for the atmosphere of Titan. And also, since the discovery of the geysers and plumes coming from Enceladus, can make measurements of the composition of that material as well. Then there's the magnetospheric imaging instrument, MIMI, and it both can do particle remote sensing of the energetic neutrals coming into its detector, as well as measure the neutrals and ions, and looks at the composition and charge and the state of the ions and electrons coming into it. And finally, of the 12 instruments on board the orbiter, there's the radio and plasma wave spectrometer, and it's a radio frequency receivers. It has three electric dipole antennas and magnetic search coils, and basically can listen to the radio waves coming from Saturn and within the Saturn system. Going on to the next slide, slide number 6, it's the same slide previously, but just replaced to show the locations of the heads of the various instrument teams. And can see that 10 of the Cassini Orbiter instruments have principal investigators or team leaders that are based in the United States. And two of those, the magnetometer and the CDA instrument, are based in Europe. And also, I didn't mention the magnetometer. With that, we can measure the magnetic field around Saturn and also look for magnetic fields around other targets of interest. With 12 instruments and no scan platform, it makes it a little bit more complex to operate the spacecraft, since, as I indicated, you have to point the entire spacecraft. And we also have a system of distributed ops, where each of the science teams is responsible for designing their observations end-to-end, the pointing, the command tables, and so on, before they are then sent up to the spacecraft. Moving on to slide number 7. This just shows the 17 countries that are involved in the Cassini-Huygens mission, the flags for those countries. And those countries provided perhaps instruments or spacecraft hardware and the scientists that are part of the Cassini mission. Moving on to slide number 8, this is numbers involved with Cassini. There's one Cassini-Huygens spacecraft and 5 scientific disciplines, and those are represented by Saturn, Titan, rings, icy satellites, and magnetosphere. There are 18 instruments total. I've discussed the 12 of those that are on board the orbiter, and there are 6 more instruments on board the Huygens probe. 27 science investigations, including a group of interdisciplinary scientists who use data from multiple instruments on board Cassini. There are 30 members of the Project Science Group. That's the executive group. That's the head of the Cassini Project Science team, or Project Science Group. Typically, at any given PSG meeting, we have 80 to 100 scientists in attendance at one time, although altogether there's about 270 scientists on the investigation team, and more than half of those are in Europe. And this 270 scientists, of course, does not include as many, if not more, science associates and postdocs that are associated with the various instrument teams. Slide number 9, just for scale, shows a picture of Saturn and also the Earth and the Moon to scale. And it shows that Saturn plus its rings just fit in between the orbit of Earth and the Moon. Saturn is the 6th planet from the Sun. It's 9.5 times further from the Sun than the Earth is. And being this distance from the Sun, it only receives about 1/90th of the amount of sunlight that the Earth receives. It's also the lightest planet, and in fact, if you could build a bathtub big enough, Saturn would float in it. At a distance of 9.5 times from the Sun, that makes Saturn's year longer, so it takes about 29.5 years for Saturn to travel once around the Sun. Its rotation rate is on the order of about 10.5 hours, although we're not exactly sure yet what the internal rotation rate of the planet might be. Moving on to slide number 10, this shows the Saturnian system. It shows the rings on the top, a view of what part of the rings look like, as well as a number of the moons shown to scale. The largest moon is Titan. It's about the size of the planet Mercury. And some of the smaller moons orbit in close to the rings, the tiny ring moons. There's also a whole host of satellites in irregular orbits that are probably captured objects well outside the main group of satellites. To date, the number of moons is up to 61. The most recent moon that was discovered was in Saturn's G ring. It's Aegean, and it was one of the many fierce giants from Greek mythology. There are seven named rings in the Saturn system, starting in close to the planet and looking at the bottom panel of that view graph. They're the D, C, B, and A rings. They're the main rings that you might see from the Earth in a telescope. Then there's the very narrow F ring, G ring, and finally the very extended E ring, where the source of those E ring particles is the moon Enceladus and the active plumes at the South Pole. Moving on to slide number 11, talk a little bit. We're in the Cassini equinox. That's the part of the mission that we're in. We've finished our four-year prime mission, and now we've completed the first year of that 2.25-year Cassini equinox mission. And it's named that because Saturn equinox occurs in August of 2009, and on August 11th, the sun will be transit from shining on the south side of the ring to shining on the north side of the ring. And if you were to look at Saturn in a telescope more recently, you would notice that the rings have gone to a single bright line as we get close to the equinox, and the rings will be essentially edge-on as viewed from the Earth. The equinox mission was driven by scientific requirements, and in particular, some of those requirements that we hadn't had an opportunity to complete in the prime mission, and then to focus on items of interest, such as observing the equinox, also to have additional close flybys of the moon Enceladus, as well as additional flybys of the moon Titan. And the goal of the equinox tour was to produce the maximum scientific return possible with the Cassini-Huygens spacecraft. And in that regard, it's similar in intensity and complexity to the Cassini prime mission. And so what we'll be hearing about today are the results from the first year of the equinox mission. Slide number 12 is a pictorial overview of what the extended mission is like, and I'll just highlight some of those activities. In the equinox mission itself, there are 26 Titan flybys, there are encounters at dusk, some high northern ground tracks to look at the wakes in the northern hemisphere, or look at the lakes in the northern hemisphere. There are seven Enceladus flybys, some of those are indeed very close. And there are additional icy satellite flybys, including one of Dione, Rhea, and Helene, and that's shown in the second year of the extended mission. Around equinox, there's an equinox campaign, including 2 months post-equinox to make observations. And there are a number of ring and Saturn radio science occultations, as well as stellar occultations. And some of these are summarized on slide 13. But in particular, in the fifth year, we've had 13 Titan flybys and 3 close Enceladus flybys. I've hit the highlights of slide 13, move on to slide 14. This shows a profile of the inclination of the orbit for Cassini as a function of time. And the arrow indicates what the profile we've looked at for the first year of the equinox mission, going out to the dashed red line. And you can see that we've been slowly coming down. We've been up at inclinations of about 65 degrees or so, and that gives us really excellent views of the poles of the planet as well as of the rings. And during that year, we've been slowly decreasing that inclination until we're now in something like the 50-degree range or so, and we'll continue to decrease until most of the second year and a quarter of the equinox mission will be in the equatorial plane, where we just pop up a couple of times to actually get occultations of the rings and of the planet. Slide number 15 shows what we call petal plots of the orbits. What you see is Saturn in the middle, and you can see the rings. Now, the first black outer circle is the orbit of Titan, and the second partial circle that you can see there is the orbit of Saturn's moon Iapetus. And the plot here is shown in distance from Saturn using Saturn's radius, or what we call R sub S, as our metric. And this first view is a top-down view if you would be looking down on Saturn's north pole. Here's what the orbits would look like. The first year of orbits of the equinox orbits are those that are in blue, green, yellow, and some of the orange orbits. And note that the sun is to the top in this profile. We use Titan as a tour engine. You notice that all of these orbits go out to or cross the orbit of Titan. And we use flybys of Titan, use Titan's gravity to shape both the size and inclination of the various orbits, and this saves us a lot of rocket fuel by being able to use the gravity of such a large moon to shape our tour. On page 16 is another petal plot. In this case, it's edge-on, so now you're looking along the equator of Saturn, and you can then now see the high-inclination orbits, those that are in yellow, green, orange, and blue. And the second year and a quarter of the equinox tour will be those that are more in the purple and in the pink at much lower inclinations. And in this case, the sun is to the right. Moving on to some of the equinox science objectives, in particular, we wanted to look for new discoveries. This included looking at Enceladus's plumes and trying to understand Titan's very complex surface. It looks very Earth-like in many respects. It has river channels, it has dunes, lakes, and other features that are very reminiscent of the Earth's surface, and I'm sure that Zibi will get into more of that. Also, for theoretical advances, it's important to understand the organic chemistry of both Titan and Enceladus. There's some complex organic chemistry taking place at these two objects. To understand something about the dynamics of the satellites, especially those that are embedded in the rings. And then something about the satellite geophysics, and a good example is the equatorial ridge that circles Iapetus, this large ridge or mountain range, and what might have caused it. There's also new opportunities, both on the temporal and spatial scale. A new season for Saturn and Titan. We're going through the equinox, the equinox ring event. That also there's new places to explore in Saturn's huge magnetosphere. It's this three-dimensional bubble, if you will, with a long comet-like tail, and we'd like to explore new regions in this particularly large environment. Also, there's some AO, or Announcement of Opportunity objectives, that we want to continue to address, in particular to get additional Titan radar coverage. We got about 22% in the prime mission, and in the 2 years of the equinox mission, we'll increase that up to about 30%. And then to continue to gather information that we need for future missions to go back to the Saturn system, perhaps to do in-depth studies of both Titan and of Enceladus. Looking at slide number 18, just want to do a quick summary or highlights of some of the prime mission results that we saw in this case for Enceladus. If you start at the left and proceed clockwise, the first image is a cartoon representing the magnetic field observations by the magnetometer instrument, and that white wisp below Enceladus is the plume of gases that's coming out, and those gases and ions distort the magnetic field lines. You can see the distortion around Enceladus, and this is what gave us our first clue that there was something unusual or different about Enceladus and allowed us then to go closer and to make the discovery of the plumes coming from the south pole of Enceladus. The next image over with the red and yellow shows what we call the tiger stripe region. And in this region, the box is the Sears temperature measurements, where the red is cooler and the yellow is warmer. And it's overlaid on top of an ISS image of the south pole of Enceladus, showing that the warmest temperatures, much warmer than the background regions on Enceladus, are around the tiger stripe region. The third one over is a color slice. It's a false color slice showing the relative intensities of the plume coming out from Enceladus, and notice that this plume is larger even than the diameter of the moon itself. Moving down into the right corner, there's an artist concept of what the plumes might look like if you could stand on the surface of Enceladus. The next view over shows a combination of both the INMS water vapor density and the cosmic dust analyzer density as a function of time, where zero would be closest approach. And we notice that the greatest intensity was a little bit before the closest approach, and it was right at the time where we had flown over the south pole of Enceladus. The next figure in the left bottom corner shows the composition measurements that were made with the ion and neutral mass spectrometer, where they detected, of course, water, methane, a host of organics, as well as carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. And in a sense, we're seeing part of what's inside of Enceladus on this material that is being thrown out through the jets and plumes of Enceladus. And then the final image is a temperature map of Enceladus, where you can see the yellow there is the much warmer southern polar region of Enceladus, much warmer than we expected compared to the background temperatures of Enceladus. As far as Enceladus flybys go, on slide number 19, so far we've had 6 flybys. 3 of those were in the prime mission, and E4 through 6 were in the last year, and Zibi will be talking about the results from those. And if you look at the various profiles, what we've been doing is very slowly going deeper and deeper into the plume region until toward the end of this year in November, we'll actually be going very close, within just 100 kilometers, right through the South Polar region, through the plume region. Slide number 19 shows some of a summary of what we have discovered in the prime mission about Titan. It's a very complex surface and its atmosphere and organics. And if you start from the left, the first image shows the detached haze, that's that faint purple above the atmosphere of Titan. The next one over is a visual and infrared mapping spectrometer image of a huge cloud system that's covering the north pole of Titan. Then next to that is a VIMS image of some mid-latitude clouds shown as those white streaks. On the far upper right shows some of the drainage channels in this three-dimensional view created from some of the Huygens probe photographs as we were descending through the atmosphere of Titan, and it shows some of the drainage channels. In the middle row, starting from the left, you can see some of the radar dunes. You can see those black lines are the dunes flowing around a raised region, perhaps a hill on Titan. You can also see some of the ion composition from the ion and neutral mass spectrometer. It shows the density of those as a function of Daltons or atomic mass units. And the ion and neutral mass spectrometer can measure up to 100 atomic mass units, and that gets up to the C7 or 7 carbon chains. And they're probably much larger or heavier organics than that. In fact, the next one shows the heavy ion chemistry from the CAPS instrument, where they're measuring in some places in the atmosphere of Titan atomic mass units of hydrocarbons that are as much as 10,000 atomic mass units. There's also an image of the mountains that are shown, as well as starting at the bottom row, there are 3 crater-like looking objects on Titan, and the very largest one, the middle one, Synlap, is about 100 kilometers across. There's also aeolian or wind-driven patterns that are present, as well as radar images of the lakes in the North Polar region. And we're very interested to watch, as the seasons change on Titan, to see if there are any changes in the North Polar region, where it's been North Polar winter on Titan thus far. Moving on to page 21, that shows the radar coverage of Titan's surface for both the Prime and the Equinox mission. And there was a descope of Cassini before its launch. We originally had a scanned platform, as well as an articulating radar antenna with the intention of being able to get synthetic aperture radar on every single Titan pass. And those descopes, with putting all of the instruments now body fixed to the spacecraft and using the high-gain antenna to perform the radar observations, has led to a sharing of Titan passes. And so it's been more of a challenge. We haven't been able to acquire coverage of the surface as quickly as we would have liked. Moving on to slide number 22, this is just an artist's concept of what a future mission to Titan might look like. We might go back with a balloon that would circle, using Titan's wind, circle Titan and make measurements of the atmosphere and of the surface. And perhaps you can just see a hint of it. Perhaps dangling on a long cord might be a set of instruments that we could briefly set down on the surface and perhaps even measure the composition of a lake as we circle Titan. We might send probes to Titan. The next step might be to put a spacecraft in orbit around Titan. There's certainly an interest to go back to Enceladus and perhaps even bring back samples of the plume material. And my final slide is what's in the future for Cassini. We have a proposed mission called the Cassini Solstice Mission. This proposed mission would be 7 years long, with its goal of lasting until the solstice, or that point in time where the sun would be at its greatest angle above Saturn and the rings. You can see in the diagram there, it shows as a function of the seasons of Titan, the prime mission. We arrived just a couple of years after the winter solstice. That's shown in green. The equinox mission in blue is focused on looking at the equinox transition for the rings in Saturn and for Titan as well. And then the proposed extended mission, what we're calling the Cassini Solstice mission, would be shown going out to the maximum opening with the sun shining on the rings. And that's indicated also in a small plot, which shows the seasonal declination of the sun and the Earth. The Earth is the blue line that goes up and down, and the sun is the red line, indicating the prime equinox and extended mission. That, I'd like to move over to Jeff Cuzzi, and he'll tell us about what amazing discoveries and what new things we've found out about Saturn's ring in our first year of Cassini's mission and the fifth year of Cassini's challenging and exciting time around Saturn. Jeff?
Okay. Can everybody hear me? Can anybody hear me?
Yes. I can hear you, Jeff.
Okay. So I'm up.
Pretty fine.
Sounds as good.
Okay, so before I start, if anybody is actually following these slides along in real time, I'm going to suggest, if you have not already done so, that you download the movies, because there are about five movies in this PowerPoint, or you can look at them separately, and they do add a lot to the presentation. But with that, and they're all on the same charm page with the PowerPoint. But with that, I'm going to start, and somewhat following along from what Linda did, I'm not only going to say what Cassini did over this fifth year, but I'm going to emphasize it, but within the context of what we've learned so far. So it's somewhat of a cumulative talk. All of you who have memorized the second year, third year, and fourth year talks, I'm sure there are many of you, some of this might sound familiar, but I'm going to guess that that's not generally true. Okay, so anyway, starting up on the first slide is just a beautiful picture of the rings. It's actually a two-image composite taken of the unlit face of the ring, so this is one of these geometries that we only get from Cassini. You could never see this from the Earth. Sun is shining on the north face, and we're looking at the south face. I mean, the sun is shining on the south face, and we're looking at the north face. So for most of Cassini's mission, it's been sort of southern summer. So here we are, look at the north face of the rings. And the nice thing about this, if you move on to the second slide, which indicates the main ring regions, which Linda also alluded to, you see right off that the B ring in the middle there is very dark. And that's not because there's nothing there. It's because there's so much material there that it blocks the sunlight trying to filter its way through from the lighted side. And then we have, as Linda mentioned, the A ring on the outside, the Cassini division, which separates the A ring and the B ring, which is really not a division. It's almost a ring in its own right. Then we have the C ring, and then the very faint D ring close to the planet, and the equally faint, very diffused G and E rings that are further away from the planet. And at the bottom there, you can see the very narrow stranded F ring sketched in there. It's a very interesting regime. So I'm going to talk a little bit about all these regions as I go through. So moving on, the next slide, slide 3, is actually from the lit face, more familiar view of the rings. And now you see the B ring nice and bright, brighter than the other rings because there is more material there. And you see all this beautiful fine-scale structure in the B-ring, essentially none of which we understand even to this day, but we are gathering an enormous amount of data that we will be sifting through to try to understand it. The A-ring, again, is on the right. You can see that narrow gap in the A-ring towards outside is the Yankee Gap, where there's a moonlet. I'll talk about that later. And an even finer gap very close to the edge of the A-ring, maybe only a millimeter away on this scale. That's the Keeler Gap. Okay, so I want to note the banded structure in the C-ring over to the left. This very beautiful banded structure surrounds an empty gap in the outer part of the C-ring. We don't understand that banded structure at all. It's very regular and quite beautiful and must have an explanation, but we do not have it. Okay, so moving right along from the global view, just to overview the talk a little bit, I'm going to start with discussion of the composition and the size distribution of the ring particles. I'm going to talk about, then I'm going to talk about various processes that explain ring structure, all kinds. I'm going to focus in on moonlets because the whole relationship between moonlets and rings is a very fundamental one. I'm going to talk a little bit about dust in the Saturn system and from beyond it and what an important role that plays. And just finally talk a little bit about some processes involving magnetic fields and electric forces. But I don't want to forget to say that there are some outstanding questions that we still really don't understand, including the reddish color of the rings, which I'll talk more about, how old the rings are. We don't think they're as old as the solar system. All that fine structure. I'm not going to say much more about that today, but I already alluded to that. And the structure of the C-ring, which I'm also not going to say much more about today. But just keep in mind, they are outstanding questions. Okay, moving on to slide 5. This is a stretched, enhanced color image with Enceladus in the background and the rings in the foreground. And you can see even by stretching this color image, Enceladus still looks quite white because white is just white no matter how much you stretch it. And Enceladus, the surface is pretty much pure water ice. But, of course, it's obvious from this that the rings are not pure water ice. They are red. And we have, for the first time from Cassini, as shown in this inset, we have spectra of the rings at many, many locations now through the visible, which is off to the left, and into the near infrared, and those big dips that you see going down in the sort of 1 to 4, 5 micron region are the signature of water ice. So we are quite sure water ice dominates the properties of the rings. But we can now also tell for the first time that there is an absence of other sort of candidate ices that you might have wondered if were there. There's no CO2, for instance. There's no of this what's called C-H. Those are carbon-hydrogen bonds that are found in organic materials. No evidence for that at all. Now, way over on the left-hand side of those spectra, you see the spectra dips down to the left. That's in the visible wavelength region, and that dip is what gives the rings their reddish color. So it's the details of that dip, where it happens, how steep it is, and all that, that's going to help us understand what this reddish material is, which is going to help us trace the origin of the rings. Okay, next slide. Slide 6 kind of summarizes the two current hypotheses we have for the color of the rings, and there is no agreement on which of these is right. On the left, we have organic material, such as you might find in carrots or tomatoes, and is found very, very routinely in the interstellar medium. These things are called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, and they are moderately large molecules, maybe somewhat larger than the ones that Linda showed that the INMS can detect. They're, each one of those little chains has 6 carbons in them, so you know, anywhere from, oh, I don't know, 30, 50, up to a couple of hundred carbon atoms. These things are like little pieces of graphite, and it is that property that they're a tiny little piece of a conductor that gives them this reddish color and their own characteristic spectrum. It's what makes carrots orange. It's what makes tomatoes red. On the other hand, we have the familiar rust iron oxide that we see all around us and on the surface of Mars, hematite. This, of course, is naturally occurring in nature, and we'd certainly think that that's a candidate as well. So we really don't have any preference for these right now today. But moving along to the next slide, slide 7, we can look around at the other objects in the Saturn system, in particular the icy satellites, to see how many of them are similar or not similar to the rings. On the left, you see Rhea and Dione. And crudely, you can see they kind of do look like the ring spectrum. Their spectra are flat through the long visible and near infrared wavelengths, but have this very sharp absorption at the short visible wavelengths over in the blue and ultraviolet looks a little bit like the rings, whereas Iapetus and Hyperion off to the right have a much more gradual reddening that covers all through the visible and near infrared. So that's unusual. Doesn't look like the rings. It turns out that the outer solar system icy objects that people most commonly associate organics with are more like Iapetus and Hyperion. So maybe organics, in that sense, may not be the answer. Moving on to the next slide, this is another way of looking at the ring, comparing the ring spectra with other icy objects. Here we're plotting on the horizontal axis sort of the redness at, you might say, visual wavelengths or short visual wavelengths. That's the dip that I showed you. And then the vertical axis shows you the redness or the slope of the spectrum at the longer visible wavelengths. And you can see icy satellites and rings kind of scatter all over this plot. But this big sort of blue-red ball way over to the right, that's the A ring and the B ring, and it's just nothing like any of the other icy satellites. They're much redder. However, that one black square that sits right in that very red ball is actually Triton. And the lower inset actually shows a spectrum of Triton, which varies in color, but at least in one epoch, the blue curve, it looks very much like the ring. So here's one icy outer solar system object that's very red and very much like the rings. Okay, moving on. Next slide, however, compares yet another way to look at the colors of the rings. You can here we have the redness, the short visible wavelength redness on the horizontal axis and the depth of the water ice bands on the vertical axis. And all you just the rings kind of spread throughout all those plus signs. Mostly there's a trend going diagonally from lower left to upper right. But what you notice with the asterisks that are circled in red circles is those are more of these reddish icy outer solar system objects called trans-Neptunian objects or TNOs. And you can see there the whole sense of their trend is totally opposite what the ring trend is. So this whole color and composition thing is unusual. What that means is that the TNOs, the redder ones, have less water ice. Whereas the rings, the more icy rings are actually more red. So this is an ongoing puzzle. Okay, so I want to actually skip over this slide because I'm moving a little bit behind. Let's go to, let's skip over a couple slides here. Let's go to slide 12, which is a beautiful high phase angle image of the rings taken when the sun was behind the planet. And here what's really highlighted in addition to some dust in the main rings, is the diffuse E and G rings. The E ring is the larger, blurrier of the two, and then the G ring is the one that's a little bit closer to the main rings. Here we're seeing highlighted in tiny dust grains. Next slide, slide 13, just reminds you that not only do we have pictures of these rings, and in some of these pictures and geometries, we've discovered new rings associated with some of the new small satellites and new arcs, and I'll show you pictures of those in a minute. But the spacecraft actually goes through these rings. Cassini actually measures the composition of the dust in these rings with the CDA, and the CDA has detected not only water ice, which we now comes from Enceladus, but also silicon and even some metal iron grains as well. So it's an interesting story to try to put together measuring the composition of some of these things in situ. Next slide, slide 14. I think I'm going to skip over this. It's another image taken in the same geometry by the VIMS instrument. But let's go to the next slide, which is 15, which shows a close-up of the E-ring with Enceladus over on the left buried in it. Enceladus is actually the little black dot. Zibi will certainly talk about this a little bit more, but here I just want to illustrate that, you know, all those jets and whatnot probably in some way illustrate how the jets and gas from Enceladus are feeding this entire E-ring with solid ice grains. So in a sense, the composition of measuring the composition of these grains is a way of measuring the composition of the interior of Enceladus. Let's move on to the next slide. slide 15, which actually shows a little movie. If you look quick, you'll see this G-ring arc coming around right toward the end of this movie. There it is, and there it goes again. Basically, in the G-ring, there's one particular set of longitudes that we call arc, which is full of rubble, and this rubble material is actually associated with a newly discovered moon. So go on to the next slide, and it shows you this new moon, which is right in the middle of this dense arc, which Linda alluded to. It's called Aegean. So here we have a case where this diffuse ring is fed probably by meteoroids bombarding and eroding this little moon that's out there at around the G-ring. And that rubble spreads into an arc, and then the smaller material spreads even further around and makes a complete ring. So this was something that was discovered this year. And moving on to the next slide shows actually sort of mini versions of the same effect. These are two of the little moons that were discovered by Cassini, Anthe and Methone, and you can see that each one of them has its own little rubble arc or dust arc as well. So it's a process of constant erosion of these little moonlets. And where do they come from? Or are the moonlets primordial? Are they rubble shards or pieces of some disrupted earlier moon? Is something that we really don't know. Okay, so to summarize this at the level of the composition of the rings, slide 19, the A ring and the B ring contain very, very pure water ice, but they are redder than any of the icy moons. And the spectra really don't match these red outer solar system objects, except maybe Triton, as I pointed out. And we don't see any other direct evidence for organics. So again, if there were a way to maybe get in there and measure the composition in situ somehow, that would be a fantastic opportunity. Maybe we'll get lucky at the end of the mission. Next bullet just says how Cassini has characterized the sort of larger particles, some slides that I skipped over. Most of this work was done in year four, so I didn't really say much about it. The diffuse rings, we have learned a little bit more about the diffuse rings in terms of where they are and what they're made of. And this has been something exciting this year to discover that new moonlet and that arc. Okay, let's move on to slide 20 and talk a little bit about ring vertical structure. This is an old concept of the vertical structure of the rings that illustrates how they're each, that locally they're made up of just individual ice balls, let's say, that are maybe centimeters to meters in size, all orbiting Saturn, colliding with each other. This particular concept shows the rings very vertically extended, the particles very far from each other. That's what we call the classical model. The next slide shows a more modern, more realistic model of the vertical structure, where because of inelastic collisions between the particles, where they actually lose energy in colliding with each other, they settle down into a more dense layer. So the very tiny motions of these particles relative to each other and their collisions gave the rings the nature of a very dense viscous fluid. So we talk actually in terms of pressure and viscosity in terms of trying to explain all the structure that we see in the rings. The next slide gives you an example of how this plays out. Now we're looking, in the movie, we're looking down on top of the rings with Saturn off to the left. And we're traveling along with one particular piece of orbit. So stuff to our left is moving faster and goes by us. Stuff to our right is falling behind us. Because the rings are so dense, their minute self-gravity allows them to coalesce. Little patches of ring material want to clump into groups. It's called a gravitational instability, and it's thought by some people to have played a role in the very earliest formation of the planets, our own planets and asteroids in our own solar system. So by studying this process in the rings, we get a handle on how things might have formed in a larger context. But it's this shear that keeps tearing these things apart and prevents this process from going to completion. So the rings are kind of held in this state of suspended animation, if you like, for us to observe. But this kind of tilted, stranded structure we call self-gravity wakes is observable, even though it's very small scale, much too small to see with the cameras. We can see this with our occultations, both stellar occultations by the stars and radio occultations. So the slide at the upper left kind of indicates how stellar occultations will cut through the rings at different angles, and as you cut through at a different angle, you'll see these wakes in a different projection. So by doing this in a variety of different angles and also elevation angles from the stellar occultations, you can build up like a 3D CAT scan of the rings on very small, tens of meters length scales. You learn a lot about these wakes. Next slide kind of illustrates something kind of cool. I think it's cool. This is an unlit side of the rings. And you see the C ring looks about constant brightness, but the B ring is much darker on the side closer to us than on the side further away. And this is exactly because of this wake effect that shows that the wakes are pretty much everywhere in the rings, and even in that part of the, in parts of the B ring. So, you know, over on the far side, the wakes are more aligned so that you're looking down them and more light is filtering through. On the near side, they're aligned more, you know, parallel to the orbit direction, so they're blocking each other. Very interesting stuff, and it makes it very hard to analyze the brightness of the rings with theoretical models. So that's one thing that's really slowing us down. Next slide shows a beautiful new image. This was taken recently of the very outer edge of the A ring. Now the sun is getting very low in grazing incidents on the ring, and I'll have more to say about that. Linda mentioned that as we get towards equinox. But here you see this rubbly kind of a structure in the very outermost part of the A ring, and this is actually, you're seeing lumps and shadows of vertical structures at the outer part of the A ring that might be as big as hundreds of meters or even bigger, maybe kilometers in size. And you can kind of faintly make out the kind of tilted, stranded nature of this. So this is a gravitational instability effect, only here we're actually seeing it on very large scales directly. Another manifestation of this is seen in the next slide. This is the outer edge of the B ring. Very irregular kind of brightness fluctuation seen in that bright band just to the right of the very dark gap, the Huygens gap, right at the outer edge of the B ring. None of this is really very well understood. But as Cassini homes in on this with these very low sun angles, we're just getting more information all the time. Next slide basically summarizes the dynamical processes, and I just wanted to summarize this by pointing out that one of the big advances has to do with this area of microstructure, self-gravity wakes. They're everywhere. The rings are a fluid. Self-gravity plays a role. Lumps and clumps come and go. And it's just we're just watching them evolve. And this is just one of the examples of time variation in the rings. I'm going to talk about another in just a minute. Okay, so let's move to another general subject, which is the idea of how rings and ring moons interact with each other. And this is a schematic that shows the tribes of ring moons that are around the various outer planets. Saturn has its own, 61, as Linda mentioned. The little cartoon at the bottom right indicates how a ring moon can excite a wave at one of a number of different resonances in the rings, this place where the orbit period of a particle is a simple fraction of the orbit period of the satellite, and it excites the particles there unusually strongly because of this repeated configuration that you see at a resonance. And this excitation propagates away in a spiral because of the self-gravity of the rings. The next slide kind of shows you some of these spirals, slide 28. In the rings, they're very tightly wrapped. They're like a watch spring, but they are related to the same physics as arms of spiral galaxies. And by combinations of stellar occultations and images, we can learn a lot about the rings, including what the mass density is locally from the wavelengths. We can learn about the mass of the rings, and we can learn about the mass of the moons. So one thing we learned, it says at the bottom of the slide, that all these little ring moons that are driving these waves are just rubble piles. They're not solid. We can measure their mass directly this way. You can measure their size by taking pictures of them, so you know what their density is, and it's quite low, all of them, which is very interesting, and I'll get back to that in a minute. Turns to the surface mass density, this plot basically shows you at the bottom how the surface mass density of the rings varies across the A ring. The top plot shows a profile of optical depth for how much material blocks the starlight. You can see there's really very little agreement there. So how can you have more mass density right in the middle of the A ring, where actually most of the blockage of the light is at the inner A ring? So this is kind of peculiar, and it tells us something about the size of the particles and how it varies from place to place. But this mass density is the critical thing. We need to know the mass density of the rings to understand how long they could have survived due to evolutionary processes, which I will get to in just a few minutes. But here, we measure it, so we know what it is. Well, here we are. What is the mass of the rings? We measure it. And so we have a very good example of it. The B ring is a little bit more problematic because we don't have all these spiral density waves in the B ring, so it's a little harder to get a handle on it. And you remember my very first slide I showed you, that's probably where almost all the mass is. So some people have argued that there could be so much mass hiding and lurking unseen in the B ring that the mass of the rings might be much higher than we're estimating right today. And this would have some implications about the age of the rings because they get polluted by meteoroids falling on top of them. The more mass there is, the more easily they can avoid being polluted. So this is a bit of a trade that I'm going to talk about a little bit later. Okay, next slide. I want to talk a little bit about embedded moonlets here. This is a sort of a classic example of this is the Yankee gap in the A ring on the left, and then the Keeler gap also in the A ring on the right. Keeler gap is much narrower. At the bottom, you're seeing a movie, which is a dynamical simulation of what these moons do. You can tell a little bit better from the Keeler gap picture, which has the little tiny moon Daphnis in it, that there's a little wake on either side of that gap that's caused by Daphnis, and this is a wake in ring material that has flown past the moon. Just like water flowing through a river over a rock, there's a ripple mostly downstream. We see these ripples downstream of the moon. So because ring material flows, let's say in the case of the Keeler gap, downwards on the left of Daphnis and upwards on the right, that's why the wakes are asymmetric. So you can tell a lot about the mass of the moon that way. And it's this process by which the moon excites the material on either sides of the gap that allows the moon to clear the gap. So here we have a nice analogy to process that might go on, again, in the protoplanetary nebula with moons like, with planets like Jupiter and Saturn opening big, huge gaps in the nebula. So here we can study it close at hand. So these are two good cases where we actually understand that there's a moon and it's causing a gap. But there are other cases that are more puzzling in the Cassini division and the C-ring where we see gaps but no moons. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. Next slide shows a really nice little movie of Daphnis going around. And you can here see directly how the little wake associated with Daphnis moves right along with it. So just like the wake in the river is fixed to the rock, the wake in the ring is fixed to the moon. But the next slide are some stills. And what we really see here is that there are actually shadows cast on the ring by the moon and by the wake. So these are taken very recently now. We're getting very close to equinox. So the sun is coming in at a very grazing angle. So as you know, any time the sun is at a grazing angle, all kinds of subtle vertical relief gets exaggerated, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. So this little moon, Daphnis, actually comes out of the vertically out of the Keeler gap, which is one reason why it's cast in the shadow, and because it has this inclined orbit, its wake also has vertical motions. We don't see this associated with the Yankee gap in Pan, so it's a very interesting effect. Okay, let's move on. We're now on slide 30. I mentioned to you that the density of these little moons is known. We think they're rubble piles. Here's kind of an example of some of these. Pretty cool, the little moon Pan, which is in the Encke Gap, and the little moon Atlas, which is right outside the A-ring. They kind of look like flying saucers because they are aligned, and little ring material tends to pile up on their equators. And then they achieve this equilibrium shape that is what they can hold on their surfaces due to self-gravity. It's called their Roche lobe. So we know that they're just rubble piles with no strength by their shapes as well as their densities. Okay, moving on to slide 35. There's a whole new class of objects that's been discovered in the rings. We call them propellers. We don't see them directly. Well, we call them propellers because of how they disturb the surrounding ring material. They are too small to open a gap, but they do disturb the material on either side. Sort of the lower left panel shows, and the lower right panel shows some computer simulations of what happens to ring material as it flows past these guys from right to left and from left to right. Again, it's like the wake. The disturbance is in the downstream side always. But you can see how these guys kind of carve out a little hole, a little double dash pattern associated with them. And the next slide shows let's go to slide 36 anyway. At the upper right of slide 36, it kind of shows you some of these little double dash patterns, which is how we detect these propellers. And then you can see how tiny they are compared to the big picture of the ring. The left-hand slide at the top shows three little red dashes, which indicates, again as shown at the bottom right, that these things are only found in three separate radial bands in the A-ring. We don't find them other places. So what are these things? Are they shards or fragments of primordial moon that got broken up by something? Or are they something that just forms locally? We don't know, but we're certainly interested in them. The slide at the bottom left indicates that they don't have very much mass. This is the number density versus size. The square and the solid line basically off to the left shows you all the ring material, the ring particles, the meter size, a couple meter size ring particles. The fact that these lines all diverge very steeply down to the right from that square tells you that none of these moons, none of these propellers has as much mass in them as the ring material itself. So again, getting back to this, you can't hide mass here. Next slide is a picture that kind of gives you an idea of a whole swarm of these guys, kind of what they look like. There are many, many of these propellers. And the red line indicates the nominal inner boundary for one of these belts. So you can see there just isn't anything to the left or inwards of the boundary, but there's plenty and plenty of them outside. So it's a very interesting population that we want to understand some more. Okay, moving on to the F-ring. This slide kind of just puts the F-ring in perspective. It's a couple thousand kilometers outside the edge of the A-ring, which is at the left with the Encke Gap and the Keeler Gap. Here we're seeing a box around the F-ring and its nearby moon Prometheus. Next slide just kind of reminds you that Prometheus is probably the driving force in some of these channels and streamers and things like this that we see in the F-ring. As Prometheus and the F-ring go around in their eccentric orbits, Prometheus will cause these kind of streamer-like structures that you can see in the simulation at the bottom right, assuming you're looking at the movie, and also in the picture in the bottom center. So these structures are pretty well understood, but going on to the next slide, there's a lot of things we don't understand about the F-ring. It's even more interesting than that. Lots of stuff happening all the time, new clumps coming and going. The bottom right shows some object that was identified back in 2004. It's now been seen both inside and outside the F-ring. Here we see it looking like a little clump with a trailing structure. Doesn't always look that way. On the left, you see these a projection of the F-ring, a complete set of longitudes, with all these little jaggedy structures and these wispy jets going off at an angle with a model below it. So each one of these jets going off diagonally represents a crossing of some object through the F-ring with a collision, just knocks stuff out of the F-ring. So you can tell there are numerous of these objects crossing through the F-ring, not to mention all the little guys that are probably causing these little sawtooth spikes. So it's a fascinating environment, lots going on, very little understood. Okay, moving on, I just want to briefly mention, looking ahead a little bit, slide 41, Prometheus and the F-ring both have eccentric orbits, but they precess around at different rates. So when Cassini got to Saturn in 2004, these orbits were kind of nested, as shown at the upper left, Prometheus in the blue and the F-ring in the red. But in the 5 years since then, Prometheus's orbit has slewed around a half an orbit more than the F-ring. So now Prometheus is at its furthest point in its orbit when the F-ring particles are at their closest. So it comes very close to the F-ring, and it's perturbing it much more strongly than before. An example of what we might see, the most extreme piece of this actually happens later this year, and what we might see, it might take a while for this kind of stirring to lead to collisions. The bottom left shows some Hubble pictures that were taken in 1995 and 1996, which is about 2 or 3 years after the last time this happened. Okay, so what they saw was some giant clumps in the region of the F-ring, the likes of which we have not yet seen with Cassini. So this is something to look forward to over the next couple of years. And before I forget, by the way, it's been pointed out, as many of you know, a big comet just recently hit Jupiter. So that's two impacts on Jupiter in the last 15 years or so, 13 years. And Cassini will be at Saturn, hopefully, for that long. And the rings present an even bigger target than Jupiter does, and they're even closer to the Kuiper Belt. So it's not out of the question for us to speculate that there might be still a large impact on the rings while Cassini is there, and that's pretty exciting to speculate about. Anyway, let's move on to the next one just quickly. This is a picture of the Cassini division with a hugely bright diffuse ring in the outer gap that was simply not there when Voyager went by and not there when Cassini got there. So just over a couple of years, this ringlet has enormously brightened. Something happened there, stirring up all this dust. Another example of strong time variation, and this was a result from this year. Okay, well, let's see. I think I'm just going to just skip over this slide. If you want to read it, you can. We've certainly discovered lots of going on with the rings and the ring moons. Let me just point out, though, this puzzle that I mentioned in the first bullet. We have not found embedded moons in any of those gaps in the C-ring or in the Cassini division. So this is a puzzle. So as we go on into the next couple of years of the mission, we're going to be looking harder for those. Maybe I will just, again, highlight we've got this unique population of propellers, and the F-ring is this bumper car zone. Okay, next slide, 44, highlights one of the other big unknowns, the dust and meteoroid distribution. I want to say a little bit about this because with all these things falling in and hitting the rings, it's a little 10 and 100 micron particles that probably contain most of the mass. And as you know, meteoroids coming from comets largely are 30% carbon and 30% rock. So they're going to darken up these icy rings. The rings are almost pure ice. I said that in slide two. But yet, they should be getting darkened all the time, and yet they're not, which has led us to this concept that maybe the rings are not as old as the solar system. But to really nail that down, we have to have a measurement of the mass, which we haven't got yet. And the fourth bullet indicates that we're going to try to measure it with Cassini in the equinox mission, maybe later this year, and again in the solstice mission by flying past Rhea, which acts as a little amplifier for meteoroids. So it's surrounded by a little cloud of ejected dust, and we want to measure that. So that's one thing we really need to do. Okay, I'm running along a little long here. I want to skip this slide. And the next slide, we are slide 47. Just reminds you, we are starting to see these spokes again. This is probably a seasonal effect related to the charging of the rings by sunlight. And so now that we're getting back in the same kind of low sun angle geometry that Voyager saw, we're starting to see the same kind of spokes as Voyager saw. So to be able to watch this, again, go through the low sun angle phase we're in now and then back to the high sun angle phase is something we're going to do. Slide 48 just kind of illustrates this. This is a plot of the elevation angle of the Earth and Sun from the rings. The wiggly line is the Earth because the Earth has a little bit of an inclination as well, and it goes around its orbit. The red line is the Sun, and you can see right around now, we're right around the time, I think this is next month, when the Sun will be exactly edge-on to the rings. So all kinds of strange illumination effects are going to transpire at that time, even more than we're seeing right now. Here's one interesting, next slide, 49, shows you something kind of cool that we're seeing now. There are actually shadows of the little moons that are falling on the rings because this elevation angle is so low. This is a shadow of Mimas, actually taken at several different longitudes. And the really weird thing about this is we're actually looking at the unlit side of the ring, and the shadow of Mimas is falling on the opposite side of the ring, but it's being actually obscured and washed out by Saturn light illuminating the thick parts of the ring in this picture. So the parts of the ring where you're not seeing the shadow are optically thick parts of the rings that are illuminated by not from the Sun, but by light reflected from Saturn. So it's very confusing and challenging. It's a lot of fun. Okay, I'm going to skip this one. Slide 51 just kind of summarizes where we're going over the next 10 years, but I think I'm going to skip over that too. Save that for the six-year charm summary and just wrap up with this summary slide, slide 52. Overall, the rings really are very dynamic and variable in time throughout the rings. The F ring, astonishingly so. The little ringlets we're seeing in these gaps, the D-ring changes, things come and go, the wakes are there, flowing, changing all the time, on all time scales, weeks, months, decades. So we're just happy to sit and watch all this transpire and imagine the even more extreme things we might be able to see as time goes on. Second, the composition of the rings probably is going to be our best clue to their origin, but because of this meteoroid infall, our expectation is that the composition has changed quite a bit with time, so we have to kind of back some of this out to infer what the original starting composition might have been. And clearly this redness is a very important aspect, but we really need to understand more what is it, this iron oxide kind of thing, or is it an organic kind of thing that's causing that? It's just not known. Okay, I'd say just the moonlets. We've got embedded moonlets that we can see and embedded moonlets we can't see. We're constraining their distribution and their radial distribution and their size distribution, and we're going to look very hard for moonlets in some of these gaps where we haven't seen them. So that is the end of my story. I could pass it on to Zibby if people don't have any questions. Dead silence. Zibby, okay. Take it away.
All right. Okay, I'm going to summarize the highlights for Titan and the other satellites of Saturn in the last year. The second slide is actually just a neat image of Titan taken during eclipse, actually, with Saturn shine. And you've already seen the third slide, in fact. It's just an overview of the mission and where we are in it. So again, we're at the end of the fifth year, and we've had several more Titan flybys this year, and I'm going to start by talking about those. There's a list of the encounters on the fourth slide. T-45 through T-57 occurred in the fifth year of the mission. It's been another busy year for those of us planning and studying planning Titan observations and studying Titan. The fifth slide has an updated map of the surface of Titan. This is a map made from images taken by the Imaging Science Subsystem. So these are all at 938 nanometers, just out in the near infrared. And that's showing dark surface features, some of which, the ones at the equator, we know are dunes of particulate hydrocarbon material. But the ones at the in the polar regions, in the North Pole, is becoming more and more visible as we move close to the northern vernal equinox, are actually hydrocarbon liquids, and there's been some more work, more evidence of that in the past year. The sixth slide has maps of the poles. The one on the right is the South Pole, and we imaged that fairly early on. Most of the images making up that map came from the first couple of years of Cassini's mission. But the one on the left is the North Polar region. There's still an area that we haven't seen very well yet, and we've been getting data more recently that fills in part of that, and obviously one of the goals as we continue on, now that the illumination is better, is to hopefully get more observations of to fill in that region. We can actually see slightly beyond the terminator, which is why the North Pole has been covered in part, because the scattering in the atmosphere, which makes it so difficult to see the surface at visible wavelengths, also actually illuminates the surface beyond the terminator. So we've seen we're getting to fairly complete coverage of the North Polar region. There are lakes and seas there. The red outlines in this map show the areas where dark features have been mapped. Most of those correlate in the left image of the North Pole with images of observations of lakes made by Cassini's radar instrument. On the right, the outlines also show these albedo features that we've seen with the Imaging Science System. The radar hasn't, the geometry of the flybys haven't allowed until recently many radar passes of the South Polar region, but that is changing and will be, that's a result for next year's telecon. One of the things, one of the lakes you'll notice in the right on the South Polar map is outlined in blue. And if you go to the next slide, one of the results that came out this year is an observation of changes at the South Pole, in the South Polar region of Titan. The seventh slide shows on the left two observations that were actually taken in the summer. It's one observation, sorry, two different versions. One's annotated, one's not. The left column is observation from the right after Saturn orbit insertion. There was a distant Titan flyby in July 2004. A little under a year later, in June 2005, there was another observation of the South Pole. And these are about the best observations that the ISS instrument has had of the South Polar region. The very bright features, the very white features, are clouds, and you can see that those change, which one would expect. The weather changed over the year in between these two observations. Many of the dark features are the same from observation to observation, and that also one would expect. The relative albedo varies because the geometry of the two observations was somewhat different, and because we learned between the two a lot better how to take images of the surface of Titan. The first one was the images, you know, in the very first Titan flyby, and it was a distant flyby. We were still optimizing the signal and noise, so that's another reason that the second observation is a little sharper. Nonetheless, there is this region that's circled in the annotated versions at the bottom that has a significant amount of very dark material in the later observation that wasn't there in the earlier observation. So this suggests to us, combined with the information from Earth-based, from ground-based observers on Earth, that there was a very large cloud outburst at the South Pole in October of 2004, so between these two observations. This suggests that there was a that storm created a lot of precipitation that, that flooded the surface, and that what we're seeing here is material is liquid methane that rained out and flooded the surface, and that, that caused the difference. So this is one of the reasons that having the Cassini mission, the longer the Cassini mission extends, the more we'll be able to learn about Titan, in that we'll be able to look for changes in the weather, changes on the surface that may be related to the weather or maybe aren't related to the weather, but may be related to other geologic activity. So the longer, the more time we have to make, to look for changes, the more likely we are to see changes. And it's encouraging that, that in the that early on we may have already seen some changes at the South Pole. This was right after the southern summer. So as we're moving toward northern summer, hopefully we'll continue to look and see if we see changes in the features there. I mentioned there haven't been a lot of radar observations yet of the South Pole. That's changing now. In fact, there was just a flyby a few weeks ago that observed Ontario Lacus, which is a lake that was observed. You can actually see that on Flight 7. But in the fifth year, there were some more observations of South Polar features by the radar. They haven't seen as many lakes as they do in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's intriguing that ISS has seen so many of these dark features, and radar, in the few observations they have not actually seen as many lakes. There are a number of, there are at least two explanations for that. One could be that what we're seeing with ISS are dark features that are not liquid, that are not features that are filled with liquid, and that we're seeing something that appears dark to at the wavelength ISS observes at and not dark at radar wavelengths. Another possibility is that there have been changes in between the observations. Many of the South Polar observations made by the radar instrument have come in the last year, in the fifth year of the mission. Many of the South Polar observations made by other instruments, especially ISS, came early on in the mission. And it's quite possible that liquids on the surface in 2005 had evaporated by 2009 in that four-year period. Even though Titan's atmosphere isn't quite as dynamic as Earth's, that's a fair amount of time, and atmospheric modeling suggests that it would be possible for tens of centimeters of liquid to evaporate into the atmosphere. So that's another reason that the more time we have to observe Titan, the more we'll be able to learn and to see if the to distinguish between things that look different to the different instruments and things that have changed between observations, which is an important distinction. But radar has observed the slide on slide 8. The image on the right shows kind of a basin. It's not clear the cause of this basin and whether it might be filled with liquids at some time or not. The image on the left shows a significant amount of a canyon system, essentially, at the South Pole as seen by radar. So clearly there has been liquids flowing on the surface in the South Polar region as well. Let's see. So the slide 9 shows some observations of clouds. I showed the observations of clouds early on in the mission. We've been tracking those through the mission, watching the meteorology of Titan, especially interested in how the weather changes. And clouds certainly are, as we've been watching, becoming more and more common in the north as the north is moving towards spring. But we are still seeing these clouds persisting in the south even into the fall. The image on the left is an image taken by the Imaging Science Subsystem. And you can see these streaks up near the North Pole, near the top of the image. North is up. And on the right, there are two images taken by the, or a set of images, two observations taken by the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer showing clouds. In this case, these clouds are in the southern hemisphere, and in one case, it's a streak, another streak. At the mid-latitudes, we tend to see these elongated streaks of clouds rather than the kind of convective cloud systems that we saw early on in the mission. The 10th slide shows two plots of the clouds as we've seen them through time. The one on the left is from ISS observations, and the color coding runs from blue to red for the where we've seen clouds throughout each year of the mission. And the slide on the image on the right, the figure on the right, shows a similar plot of observations taken by the VIMS instrument, the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer. And they too have seen clouds. We've seen clouds more and more commonly at high northern latitudes, but we're both instruments are still observing clouds in the southern hemisphere as well. So the longer we can observe, we can continue observing Titan, the more information we'll get about the seasonal change and how the weather changes along with that. It would be interesting to see, for example, if we start seeing large convective systems over the North Pole as we move into the spring and the heating at the North Pole becomes increased, similar to what we had been observing in the late southern summer when Cassini arrived. The next slide slide 11, shows some work that's been done using the dunes on the surface of Titan to understand the wind flow, the bottom of the atmosphere, the wind flowing along the surface and how it's distributing material. This is a map of Titan's surface, and the arrows illustrate the direction, the average direction of the winds that are implied by the dunes seen in these regions. And then the next slide shows some higher resolution radar observations of the dunes in a couple of places. And the one on the left, there are two different versions of the image. In some areas on Titan, we have overlapping SAR data swaths, the synthetic aperture radar, the radar imaging. In some places, the swaths they take, the strips across the surface, overlap. And it's possible to get topographic information out of those overlaps, similar to the way we see with two different, each eye sees a slightly different view, and we get topographic or distance information from that. You can do the same kind of thing from the overlapping radar images. And so that's what's shown on the bottom left here. And the topography ranges from low, with the dark purples and blues, to high. It's only a few hundred meters, but that's fairly substantial, actually, for an icy satellite. The dunes indeed lie in low-lying regions and then are blocked by the higher-lying areas shown in the lighter red or green colors. The 13th slide shows is another view of dunes across the surface. They're really quite dramatic, and it's informative to see how they interact with the other features around them. As you could see in the previous slide, the high-standing material tends to block the dunes, and so you can infer in areas where we don't have topography data, you can infer from the behavior of the dunes what areas are higher standing or lower standing, as well as getting information about the prevailing wind patterns. One of the other interesting or big questions remaining about Titan is whether is the degree to which it is endogenically geologically active, whether there's been tectonic activity in the geologic past, and whether there's been cryovolcanic activity as well. The geologic the tectonic activity, there are areas where there's certainly suggestions of it, but it's not nearly as obvious as it is on many of the other icy satellites. And this is largely or may largely be due to the fact that Titan is, as Linda said, very Earth-like in many respects. It's the same reason we don't see a lot of impact craters on Titan. Clearly, the Titanian surface has experienced a similar impact crater density, you know, a similar number of impact cratering events per area as the other satellites in the Saturnian system. But we don't, when you look at Titan's surface, we just don't see lots of impact craters. I think at this point, less than 10 craters have been definitively identified. And that's similar on Earth. At this point on Earth, there are about 150 craters that have been identified, and you compare that to the Moon, which is covered with craters. And we know they would have had similar cratering histories. The reason that the Earth does not have impact craters over its entire surface is only in very small part thanks to its atmosphere. It's mostly due to the geologic modification by erosion or other geologic activity. On Earth, we know there's lots of plate tectonics, and these processes erase the craters. On Titan, similarly, we know that there is fluvial erosion, we know the wind is modifying the surface, and at the very least, those processes would destroy and disguise impact craters. And similarly, they would be disguising tectonic features. We have similar problems on Earth trying to identify tectonic features that have been greatly eroded, deeply eroded by later processes. So it makes doing geology of Titan from orbit that much more challenging, because on Earth at least we can go out and dig into the ground or use in situ methods to discover what the geologic history is, and on Titan we're limited to doing it from orbit. So there hasn't been a lot of definitive evidence of tectonic activity. There are hints of it, and similarly, the possibility of cryovolcanic activity is something that we're inferring from the morphology of features on the surface. There's an intriguing feature, Hotei Arcus, that has always stood out from early on. The upper left-hand picture shows a combined VIMS and ISS observation, and there's this bright patch over Hotei, which is often called the smile. And it stands out very brightly at 5 microns. There are only a couple of features on Titan that are bright at 5 microns. And one of the theories had been that the material, the composition of the material on the surface is different. That's why it's bright there. And one of the theories had been that this could be related to it being recent as a result of potentially cryovolcanic activity. In the last year, this region has been imaged by VIMS at higher resolution, and that's shown in the lower left, and by radar at high resolution, shown on the right, and there's also some topographic radar data. And there are certainly intriguing compositional differences, and there are also the morphology of the features seen by the radar is suggestive of flows that one might expect from cryovolcanic flows. So there's some intriguing hints that we have found some evidence of cryovolcanic activity on Titan. And in fact, there have been some suggestions that areas have changed a little bit in this area and a nearby area. Changes have been observed, and it's been speculated that may also be due to some very recent cryovolcanic activity, and there's still a lot of work going on to investigate that. So now I'm going to change gears and talk about the other satellites. Slide 16 shows it's the same mission overview we've seen a number of times before. In the fifth year, for the other satellites, there weren't any close encounters with satellites other than Enceladus, but Enceladus had 3 close encounters that were indeed quite close. Nonetheless, there have been many observations made at long range of some of the other satellites, and just moving through some of those quickly, there's an obs- the 17th slide shows moderate resolution images of Janus at the upper, at the top of the slide, and also Helene, which is a Trojan satellite in the same orbit as Dione. It leads Dione in its orbit, and it's a small satellite there. And a relatively recent image of Tethys showing the very large Odysseus crater on the right and Penelope on the left. And a recently released map of the surface of Tethys as well. The 20th slide shows two new views or recent views of Dione, showing both the tectonic structures that we can see that look so wispy and almost diaphanous at long range, which are quite sharp fractures up close. And then on the right, an image from last winter showing some massive impact scars. And then another neat comparison. This is Mimas on slide 21. On the left, it's eclipsed by Saturn's rings, and on the right, it is an eclipsed view show from the same geometry. And you can see the umbra and the penumbra of the rings across the surface of Mimas, which is quite dramatic. So I'll finish up by discussing the Enceladus encounters. Slide 23 summarizes those encounters. There have been 7 to date, and as I said, 3 were in the last year, and 2 of those were quite close. The geometry is shown on the right, and you've seen this before as well. There are also 2 more encounters coming up in just a few months. There's an updated map of Enceladus on slide 24. And then slide 25 shows a view of the south polar region of Enceladus, and then some of the plume sources, the known plume sources that have been triangulated from observations of the plumes, are circled in the on the surface in that image. And these were targeted during some very high-resolution opportunities during the very close flybys. These were actually referred to as skeet shoots. The camera was we targeted as we're flying by so quickly, it's very difficult to take images because the spacecraft motion across the surface is so rapid, and so we targeted points along the ground track as best we could, and actually came up with some pretty spectacular images at very high resolution of the surface near the along the Tiger Stripes and near some of the plume sources. Slide 26 shows 2 mosaics from the first skeet shoot during the August encounter, and the circled regions show some of the plume sources, the known plume sources that are in these images and where they fall. The area on the mosaic on the left, the resolution is actually under 30 meters per pixel, and on the right, it's 10 to 24 meters per pixel, so these are really quite high resolution. There are a couple of those images blown up on this 27th slide. The one on the right is actually from the bottom. It's from the bottom right image mosaic in slide 26. It's actually rotated from that geometry. The one on the left is at 10 meters per pixel, similar to one of the very early close observations, very high-resolution observations of Enceladus. The surface looks very blocky at this resolution. There's clearly a lot of debris on the surface. We don't actually know how typical that is of icy satellites in general. We don't have a lot of opportunities to look at icy satellites at 10 meters per pixel, and it's probably something it would be good to do because we, as I said, we don't know how typical this is, if this is unique to Enceladus, or if it's what everything, you know, all the icy satellites look like. And then the one on the right is about twice that. It's about 18 meters per pixel. let's see, the 28th slide shows a dramatic view of the tectonics of Enceladus. It was taken right after the first flyby last October. And then there was another skeet shoot during the second flyby last October. And the 29th slide shows that area, shows one of the very high resolution images from that at a resolution of 9 meters per pixel. And again, the surface in this area is quite blocky at that resolution. One of the things you'll notice, and if you go to the 30th slide, this again is one of the tiger stripes up close taken during these encounters. One of the things that's very intriguing is that in these images that show the tiger stripes up close and that have captured the plume sources, if you didn't know where the plume source was, it would be very challenging to identify the plume source. The plumes may well be on in all of these images. They're very diffuse, so they're not disturbing, they're not affecting our imaging through them. It's very hard to see the material because it is so diffuse. And it's also not apparent, there aren't great differences in the morphology of the tiger stripes along their length, which is suggestive of the hypothesis that the activity may move along the tiger stripes, and that over recent geologic history, the plume sources haven't been set in individual locations. If they were, one might expect there to be differences observed along the ridges, there are some, but they're not dramatic. Let's see, slide 31 is another image, this one of Baghdad sulcus. And then the 32nd slide just kind of summarizes all the coverage. So the yellow circles are some of the triangulated plume sources, and then the colored squares are observations taken during the skeet shoots during those two flybys. There have also been temperature measurements made by the SEERS instrument during these flybys. The image on the left of slide 33 shows an older observation in which SEERS demonstrated that the temperature is elevated along the tiger stripes, and there's a higher resolution view illustrating temperatures up to 170 kelvins observed right along the tiger stripe in an area near the activity by the SEERS instrument. Slide 34 kind of summarizes some possible plume vent models. There's a lot of work being done to understand how the plumes actually work. And one of the recent observations from the last year that may help identify or narrow down the possibilities is that there's salt in the particulate. There's salt observed in the particulate material coming from Enceladus. There isn't in the gas. There's no sodium in the gas, and so that narrows down the source, the way in which the salt is incorporated. So it seems, for example, that the violent boiling near the surface, the model A on the left, you would expect a different distribution of the salty material, and therefore they ruled out this study that came out this year, ruled that out. It seems most likely that the salt, that there's a perhaps saline liquid water reservoir under the surface, and that there is vapor coming up from that. That's the model that enables you to keep the source warm enough that you can continue to erupt material and simultaneously not deposit enough material on the channel leading from that reservoir to the surface so as to close off your own vent. So there's still quite a lot of work that's being done in that to understand the plumes, and there's a lot of data that need to be added to these models to constrain them completely. But this observation certainly has made a great advancement in that understanding. Also, on slide 35, there's a couple of examples of comparative planetology, looking at Earth, actually, at looking at spreading centers on Earth and in comparison to tectonic features we see on Enceladus, and in some places there's some intriguing comparisons. The image on the left is showing an offset spreading center, and you see a similar morphology on Enceladus. The images, the terrestrial images, come from the seafloor bottom along near spreading areas. And then on the right, there's a pair of observations comparing a transform fault on Earth to a similar structure on Enceladus. And so comparisons like this can help us to understand what the geology on other bodies is. Sometimes those comparisons work very well. Sometimes they can be misleading, but it's very helpful to have some comparisons when you're working with such an alien body. The 36th slide shows tectonic features at a much smaller scale. These are some very high-resolution images, just a few tens of meters per pixel, that and just showing the fracturing of the surface of Enceladus. The one on the right was actually taken a few years ago, and it's a near equatorial view. You can see there are a few impact craters visible. They're being slowly eroded away, and there are a number of generations of fine fracturing going in various directions. Near the South Polar Terrain boundary, observed just last fall, at similar resolution, we see a lot of similarities, and in that there are multiple sets of these fractures cutting the surface in different directions, and that gives us information about the stress history and the directions in which the surface has undergone some, in this case, extension. It's quite a complex history. It's going to take a long time to back that out, but it's impressive to see just how fractured the surface is all, and this stretches across from, as I said, the South Polar Terrain boundary up to the equator in these two observations. So it's there's been a lot of history, a lot of complex geologic history on Enceladus, not just near the South Polar region. And underscore that, the 37th slide shows some other observations of Enceladus, some global scale observations showing higher northern latitudes, and those are very different. That's the area on Enceladus that has a fairly old cratered surface, and it's something that makes it even harder to understand Enceladus, because the surface geology is so heterogeneous. To be able to explain a cratered body, or to be able to explain a completely tectonically and cryovolcanically active body, is actually rather easier than to explain a single body that has terrains that have that much variation in them. Now you can see, especially on the left, right near the terminator, the craters, actually the centers of the craters are bowed up. That is indicative of crater relaxation, that the ice has actually flowed. So that means that the ice must be warm enough to have undergone some viscous motion during over geologic timescales. So they're not pristine impact craters. Nonetheless, it's a much older territory than we see at the South Pole, and it's a challenge to understand what can cause such great heterogeneity on the surface, and to try to infer from that how much heterogeneity there is within the interior and how deep that goes. The 38th slide just shows the upcoming, it's the same list of Enceladus encounters, but I wanted to mention that there are two coming up this November and then two next spring. And also on the 39th slide in the next year, there are, as well as those four Enceladus encounters, there's a Rhea encounter, Helene, and a close encounter with Dione as well. So there's a lot to look forward to, as well as several Titan encounters. And I'll end there. Take questions.
I have a question.
Okay.
On Enceladus, when you talk about the craters no longer looking pristine, you said they're eroded. Does the word eroded apply when you have a heat underneath of relaxing them? And is there any evidence of surface erosion, aeolian or something like that?
Right, they're modified. I wouldn't, if I said eroded with respect to Enceladus craters, I didn't intend to. They are modified by viscous creep relaxation.
Right.
There is some mass wasting of craters. It's actually quite common on icy satellites. You get landslides, downslope motion. There's some very dramatic examples of landslides on many of the icy satellites, and that would also be occurring on Enceladus. And so that is a mechanism of erosion. But Enceladus doesn't have, there isn't evidence of aeolian erosion or any of those forms of erosion, just the mass wasting and then the modification by viscous creep relaxation.
And, of course, I have to ask about what the best theories are on the source of heat in Enceladus now.
Enceladus, there's not a significant amount of tidal heating in Enceladus, but there may be enough that if it was warm to begin with, that the that you can keep it warm through the age of the solar system. But once it gets cold, it would turn off without the temperatures would stay cold the way say Mimas in comparison is.
That sounds like a tough one.
Pardon?
That sounds like a tough one. To hang your hat on that it's remained warm the whole time.
There are models that show dynamically that it can stay warm if it started off warm, and most things do from accretion. But that may constrain the timing at which Enceladus formed relative to the decay of short-lived radionuclides. But it's a very important question.
And does anyone believe that radioisotopes may be a heat source there?
Oh, certainly. It depends. As I said, it depends on the timing, and this may constrain that timing. If the only way to get enough heat into Enceladus is to have had it formed when the short-lived radionuclides were still active, then that would very tightly narrow down when Enceladus must have accreted.
And with long-lived radioisotopes, what would those be? And
those certainly would also have added to the heating, but maybe not sufficient in the most recent models I've seen, which actually aren't, which was getting to be a little while ago now. So I'm not sure what the current state of the art is, but at the time. The results I saw, the long-lived radioactive nuclides weren't sufficient to get Enceladus this warm.
And do any of these models explain why the heat appears to be localized in the southern hemisphere?
It's possible, given the activity and the difference is a little bit of a topographic difference. I think the bigger question is why it is localized. Once it's localized, it's actually dynamically stable at the South Pole, and you could actually get wander of the planet such that would migrate to the South Pole. Not that it migrates along the surface, but that the whole planet turns so that that's at one of the poles. The bigger question is why it's localized to begin with, and that gets to the heterogeneity I was talking about, the fact that many of the areas are much colder. It suggests that maybe there's some heterogeneity in the interior, but it's a big question that's still outstanding.
And is Enceladus tidally locked?
Yes, I believe so.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any other questions out there? Okay, I have a question for each of you. If you could let's say, many decades from now, get a sample from Saturn anywhere in the Saturnian system that you could hold in your hands and examine to your heart's content in the lab, what would it be and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's a tough question, I think. For me as a ring scientist, it would be great to go to the rings and maybe collect samples from each of the different rings and have that to look at, although there are other intriguing places, certainly, to get a sample.
Yeah, that's what I'd say.
So I would actually, I would differ. I think it would be fascinating to dig up a scoop of the dune material on Titan to understand what makes up the dunes. We think it's particulate hydrocarbons that have precipitated out of the atmosphere. If so, how the material gets to be of the size necessary to saltate and form dunes is a major mystery. So I think it would be fascinating to see what forms those dunes, what the material composition is.
How about putting a bucket down in one of those lakes?
Yeah, that would be good, too.
Yeah, I think that would be a cool thing to do, too, or maybe landing on Enceladus and getting really close to one of those vents and collecting a sample there.
Yep.
Thanks for indulging me.
Nobody wants any tar from Iapetus?
Well, you could do the same. You could say the same for Hyperion. It would be interesting, especially to have those samples from each to compare them, understand why they look so different.
Maybe in the far, far distant future we'll have a base on one of the moons, and then we can go check out a little bit of everything.
There you go. That's what we need.
Yeah, I think that composition, that spectral difference I showed between Hyperion and Iapetus as a pair and all the other icy satellites is very, very interesting. So I think Hyperion, and of course Hyperion's surface morphology is so odd. You know, you really got to wonder what it is.
Okay, with that, we are about to lose our connection here. I want to thank all of you for participating. I think it was really interesting, and good luck on the next 5 years.
Thank you. Bye.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.